Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
In this edition, making cities resilient to climate change.
Probably around the year 2020, things are going to turn and feedback loops are going to kick in. Nature will control what happens, and nature has a way of taking its revenge.
Lured by false promises, Africans are stuck in Georgia.
People are led to believe that through Georgia, they can easily enter into their desired country of destination, which mainly are countries in Europe. They may be deceived, so they end up stranded.
And singing for change.
We have African people everywhere in the world, but the message, it's more for everybody, everywhere.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. Located at the crossroads of Europe and Asia, Georgia has always been a multicultural melting pot. Once a Soviet republic, today in the midst of a rapidly changing global community, Georgia's role as a bridge from east to west is now expanding south, as migrants from the African continent are beginning to arrive. Whether they intend to continue west to seek better lives or try their luck in Georgia, these new immigrants are faced with a myriad of challenges in a country not quite prepared to receive them, as Paul Rimpel discovered.
Every morning, Nigerian national Sylvester Jideofor Chinyelugo goes to work at a little neighborhood car wash around the corner from his cramped one-room flat in Tbilisi. His meager earnings support his wife Linda from Cameroon and their baby girl Adora, who was born in Georgia.
I'm a student in Georgia. That is why I decided to stay. I did my master's and doing my doctorate. That is why I still stay in Georgia. Nevertheless, I like the political atmosphere in Georgia. It's more better than what I've seen in some areas. So that is why I decided personally to stay.
Sylvester and his family are among a small but growing number of Africans who have arrived to try their luck in this former Soviet republic. It's a venture where the odds are stacked up against them. Georgia's official unemployment rate is 16%, although unofficial estimates place the number as high as 70. But Sylvester, an engaging young man with a confident smile and a master's degree in European studies from Tbilisi State University, is determined to beat the odds. In an environment where neighborhood men hang out on the streets and complain there is no work, Sylvester, a former kickboxer, washes cars as he prepares to return to school for a doctorate in international relations.
Sincerely, I don't actually know why people are coming. But for me, I came here for a purpose, which I think partially I've achieved 60%. But for me, I think I'm happy because I've been going to Europe, Holland, Germany, France, still come back to Georgia. So if I think Georgia is not too good for me, I would have gone and never come back. But for me, I think I have something doing in Georgia, something reasonable. That is why I still see myself in Georgia.
The number of African migrants entering Georgia has been steadily increasing over the past 5 years. According to the Georgian Ministry of Internal Affairs, nearly 5,000 Africans entered Georgia in 2011. Some 4,500 departed. That's 1,000 more entries and exits than the previous year. However, it's impossible to discern how many Africans are actually living in Georgia based on this data. Some apply for residence permits, while others renew their tourist visas. Unlike neighboring countries, Georgia has a relaxed visa regime, where most anybody can easily enter the country. Leaving the country, though, is much harder to do. Mark Holst, the program coordinator at International Organization of Migration Mission to Georgia, explains.
People are led to believe that through Georgia, they can easily enter into their desired country of destination, which mainly are countries in Europe. They may be deceived, led to believe that exit from Georgia is a piece of cake and can be easily achieved, but it's often not. Entry into Georgia is not a problem, but then the actual departure is not easy because the border checking upon exit is pretty strict, and people often, I think, get mistaken in that. So they end up stranded. They may even end up in prison because they try to leave the country illegally.
Con artists have been quick to exploit this vulnerability. So-called agents in the home countries advertise placements at various schools in Georgia that claim to specialize in fields like tourism and hotel management, which are taught in English. In the worst cases, people are dumped in a remote hotel when they arrive to Georgia and soon discover there is no school after having paid several thousand dollars in assorted fees. Most cases, however, resemble Miriko Arimza's, a Nigerian student who paid $800 to an agent and $1,800 to a school for a six-month course, in addition to his living expenses. The school turned out to be a huge disappointment, and there was no work as promised. Now Miriko is stuck in Georgia. Like many victimized Africans, he has come to the car wash to seek Sylvester's advice.
My agent promised me when I get here, I school and I work over here. Life will be easy for me, but life is difficult for black people in Georgia because we are a foreigner and it's a language barrier. If we don't understand their language, cannot cooperate with them or do anything with them, something like job, business, it's very hard, it's very difficult. After I spend all the money, it's me, and to go back to my country is a sad story. I don't know what I'm doing. It's like I'm a crazy someone.
Here at this local football match, UC Best just scored against FC Sasko. UC Best coach and owner, Uche Uwanwe, who moved to Georgia from Nigeria in 1998, is investing heavily in his team of Africans. If they do well, the team could move up to the Premier Division, where he could try to sell his players abroad. The promise of Georgia being a launching pad for African players seeking shots in European leagues is also being exploited by criminals. Over the past year, 10 football players from Cameroon were lured by Cameroonian agents to play for an amateur team in Georgia with a promise of discovery. The owner of this team coaxed these players into paying him money, presumably, to register the team. He housed them in an unheated refugee squat where they spent the coldest Tbilisi winter in a decade with little more to eat than bread. When they ran out of money, he abandoned them. Clovis Nduta was one of the first players to arrive last August.
When we came here, we noticed that the people are not honest. Because they told us about good clubs, we look in the internet, we saw that there are good clubs and there are clubs that play Europa Leagues. So we thought that we can also have a possibility to play in one of those clubs. But when we came here, it was a different thing because they said it's very difficult for strangers to play here. They abandoned us and they went away, so we are lonely. We have no person beside us to help us, so we are lonely.
Although Georgian authorities are clamping down on local fly-by-night school placement agencies, there is nothing they can do to protect migrants from being defrauded at home. The Georgian Football Federation shrugs its shoulders at cases of scams and says if something is illegal, it's police business. Faced with the language barrier, an inherent mistrust of authorities, and no embassies, many Africans end up at Sylvester's car wash at some point, where between vacuums and washes, he functions as a mentor to wayward Africans, providing counsel and consolation.
I think before anybody does travel or make any arrangement in life or do anything in life, he must have made some feasibility studies of what am I going to do, what will be the result, what is the end product of what I'm doing, and how am I going to achieve my goal.
Sylvester estimates there are about 1,000 black Africans in Georgia. He stresses that not all are victims. Some open small businesses, marry Georgians or other foreigners, and find their way here or abroad. Nevertheless, too many people come to Sylvester after they have become victims, not before, and to this he can only shake his head as he soaps down another black Mercedes that is pulled into the garage. Paul Rimple, DW, Tbilisi, Georgia.
Cities around the world are among the first to deal with the impacts of climate change. Economic centers are often located on the sea and thus prone to increased flooding, hurricanes and other adverse weather events, which have been occurring more frequently in recent years. Last week, mayors from around the world met with experts on climate adaptation to find out how they can better protect citizens while keeping industries and infrastructures running in the case of emergencies. Helle Jeppesen attended the conference. Her report is presented by Sarah Steffen.
It sounds just like a blockbuster movie made in Hollywood. A hurricane warning causes the evacuation of Wall Street in New York. 370,000 people have to be evacuated from Manhattan. The New York Stock Exchange closes. The threat of the hurricane even impacts international markets. That sounds too dramatic? This scenario almost became reality last year in August when Hurricane Irene was heading towards New York. The city had prepared for the worst. Subways were closed, people had left Manhattan, and power lines were about to be cut. However, at the very last moment, New York's Mayor Michael Bloomberg was able to announce that Hurricane Irene would not hit the 8 million people metropolis. While New York escaped the disaster this time, most world cities need to prepare themselves for this kind of scenario in the near future. Extreme weather events like hurricanes, typhoons, flooding from rivers or the sea, as well as heat waves, are likely to occur more frequently. That's one of the findings of the so-called SREX report, the Special Report on Managing the Risks of Extreme Events and Disasters to Advance Climate Change Adaptation. It was published last week by the World Climate Council IPCC and was presented at the Bonn Conference of the International Alliance of Cities, ICLEI. Climate experts advise all nations to prepare for climate change-induced disasters. The report predicts that if action is not taken now, even though fossil fuels continue to be the main sources of energy, the CO2 increase in the world's atmosphere will cause global warming of 4 to 6 degrees until the end of the 21st century. David Catman is the president of ICLEI.
If we're talking 4 to 6 degrees, that means in all likelihood the polar caps melt, in all likelihood Greenland melts. So we're looking there at a very, very substantial sea rise.
Two-thirds of people live close to water, which means that increasing water levels will pose a direct threat to densely populated cities. While scientists agree about the likelihood of rising sea levels, it's disputed by how much the sea level will increase. IPCC experts now think that the rise will be higher than what was predicted so far. Jörn Bergmann from the UN University in Bonn.
It's quite certain that the rise of the sea level won't stop at 1 meter. We will rather have to expect 2 meters or more.
Bergmann is one of the leading experts of the World Climate Council IPCC. This rise of sea levels will make the evacuation of huge parts of cities necessary. But where should millions of people go to? After all, a rise of sea levels will not cease after a few days or weeks, like a normal flood does. It will be a permanent feature. That's why Bergmann and his colleagues say it's vital for cities not only to invest in climate adaptation, but also into emergency measures, like building dikes and flood barriers. But while too much water is going to be a major problem in the future, heat waves and droughts will also increase and take a toll on people and urban infrastructures. In London, for instance, city planners used to prepare for river floods in the past, but now droughts, which also induce water scarcity in the UK capital, were seen as even more serious threats, says Bergmann. Preparing for disasters and investing in preventive measures is expensive, and many cities are already in debt. While almost half the world's population lives in urban centers, cities cannot generate income easily. Catman again.
The reality is that most cities have 8 cents of the tax dollar.
He demands that more national tax money should benefit cities. The mayor of the city of Bonn, Jürgen Nimtsch, also sees the finance problems cities are coping with. He says that the city of Bonn received some money for flood protection, but there should be more possibilities to support urban financing on an international level.
We funded the German reunification by imposing a solidarity tax. We will also try to fund climate change adaptation measures in a similar way, but the time for that kind of instrument has not yet come.
While the members of the International City Council ICLEI have since finished their meeting on climate change adaptation for cities, international delegates are still in Bonn to discuss the UN Climate Convention to prepare the next UN Climate Summit in Dakar later this year. But as the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen in 2009 proved, the international community is slow to move on this vital issue. Mayor Nimtsch says that means cities have to take climate matters into their own hands.
If the governments and nations cannot agree on implementing measures, the city governments have to see how they can put their own rules in place on a local level.
ICLEI President Catman, a former city councillor of the Canadian city Vancouver, agrees that cities cannot afford to wait for international politics. They have to act now.
Probably around the year 2020, things are going to turn and feedback loops are going to kick in. And once that happens, then we're no longer able to control what happens. Nature will control what happens. And nature has a way of taking its revenge.
Sarah Steffen, DW.
Coming up here on World in Progress, a report about a singer from Mali who's trying to change attitudes and societies. But first, here's Kathleen Schuster with the development news.
Myanmar opposition leader to travel abroad for the first time in 2 decades. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi will deliver her first speech outside the country in June. She will speak before a UN labor conference in Geneva on June 14th, according to the International Labor Organization, ILO. Suu Kyi's speech will be a key element of her first trip abroad since 1988. After becoming leader of Myanmar's pro-democracy movement, Suu Kyi was placed under house arrest for 15 of the following 22 years of military rule. The World Food Programme fighting against the Sahel hunger crisis. Aid programs have launched a major campaign to fight the hunger crisis in the Sahel region. The UN World Food Programme, the WFP, will work with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees to help these countries. Drought has caused crop failure in the Sahel countries this year. The current military unrest in Mali has aggravated problems in the region as well. Eurovision hasn't stopped police violence. Beating and arresting protesters hasn't stopped in Azerbaijan despite the Eurovision Song Contest, this according to prominent human rights activist Leyla Yunus. The 57th annual song contest began this week in Azerbaijan's capital, Baku. Government critics have used the international event to draw attention to human rights issues there. The Azerbaijani government had relaxed its ban on opposition protests in light of the international attention, but activists continue to report violence and suppression of free speech. Former Guatemala dictator to face massacre charges. Former Guatemalan dictator Efrain Ríos Montt will face a second trial on genocide charges. A judge ruled on Monday he could be prosecuted for ordering a 1982 massacre that left 201 people dead. Ríos Montt, now 85, is already facing trial on separate charges of genocide and crimes against humanity. The Las Dos Aires village massacre was one of the worst mass killings at the height of the country's brutal 36-year civil war. Between 1960 and 1996, nearly a quarter of a million people died or went missing.
That was Kathleen Schuster with a glance at some development news. Agriculture experts say that African countries are still failing to produce enough food to feed their growing population because farmers plant poor quality seeds and yields are too low. Now, a regional seed industry alliance has been launched in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, to ensure that in the future, farmers have access to an affordable, reliable and timely supply of high-quality seeds, as well as other equipment. James Shimanyula attended the launch of the Seed Alliance.
The new Seed Alliance comprises 8 East and Southern Africa countries, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Madagascar, Malawi, Zambia and Zimbabwe. The countries unanimously agreed to work together to promote trade in high-quality seeds, strengthen communication with the seed industries in Africa and the rest of the world, facilitate movement of seed, and develop a statistical database on seed production on the continent. During the launch in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruth Semeliba, Seed Business Development Officer at the Nairobi branch of the African Seed Trade Association, decried the lack of food production in Africa.
We don't produce enough, and one of the reasons we don't produce enough is because we don't know the seed demand, we don't know how much people want. Quality of the seed on the market still leaves a lot to be desired. We still have problems. As governments, we don't have enough resources to put the regulatory mechanism in place. So people look at that as a loophole and they use it to put seed on the market. Seed that's not able to germinate. Seeds may grow properly, but they don't produce what you want.
Experts have claimed that Africa's food shortages occur because millions of people feed on maize meal, rice and beans every day, neglecting natural foods such as sorghum, millet, cassava, yams and bananas. Uganda has taken a lead in Africa as one of the few countries where people mainly eat traditional foods, as Joseph Bazal, Uganda's principal seed inspector, explains.
Traditional crops like the banana, the yams, and the cassava form part of the household food diet in the population of Uganda. In Uganda, cassava is taken as a food security crop because it can grow in the entire country. In cassava, you don't only boil the tubers, You can make a lot of products out of cassava, including cassava chips. We are also making a lot of juices from banana, which is being packaged and exported.
During the launch of the Seed Industry Alliance, Director of Business Development in Sub-Saharan Africa, Enoch Chikava, singled out Malawi and Zambia as countries that have adopted modern methods of using seeds and fertilizers in farming.
Malawi has proven that when farmers get access to technologies of seed and fertilizer, they can actually generate surplus production. Zambia, for the past three seasons, they managed to double production of the staple crop, which is white maize. Farmers were given access to seed technologies and fertilizers.
Although South Sudan is yet to become a member of the newly launched Regional Seed Industry Alliance, Chikava says the new nation may in future become one of the breadbaskets of the East Africa region.
They have good soils, they've got good weather, they have water resources, the Nile running through the country. It is actually advisable for them to look at irrigation as a way of farming. Look at Egypt. Egypt depends on irrigation. If you have irrigation, you can still become commercial.
Whether South Sudan will follow Egypt's commercial farming example to irrigate its land along River Nile is yet to be seen.
From her base in Paris, Fatoumata Diawara writes lyrics wrapped in rhythms from home in an effort to shake societies free of old traditions such as early marriage, informal adoption and female circumcision. Diawara's first album, Fatou, topped Europe's world music charts when it was released late last year, and she was recently named Best Newcomer in the Songlines Music Awards. As we hear from Alexa Dworsen, Fatou's songs appeal to an international audience, including fans in Germany.
Born in Ivory Coast, Fatoumata Diawara was sent to live with an aunt in Mali, where she was supposed to go to school. But her life took a very different path once she got involved in film and theater.
I left my family to be free, to open my mind. Nobody did that before in my family. That was a big change of my life, to be different woman.
Singing in her native Bambara, Mali's lingua franca, Fatou blends her West African Wasulu style with nuances of folk, jazz, and rock, challenging her compatriots to abandon cultural practices that lead to gender inequality. In this song, Bisa, a bride is so disappointed in the man she married for love that she wonders if she'd been better off in the arranged marriage she rejected. When we first met last year, Fatou had just given a solo performance at London's Royal Albert Hall. With the release of her album, her career went global. Touring with a band, she's been booked from Australia to Canada, with dozens of concerts in Europe in between, including Cologne's Philharmonic Hall. How did all this happen to someone who just turned 30?
I really don't know. I cannot explain exactly what's happening, but what I know, it's we enjoy it. It's amazing to see the audience so happy after the show. Beautiful.
I can't forget the meaning of your songs. So is it possible to be in a party mode when you're singing about such serious subjects like illegal immigration, female circumcision, forced marriage?
I do that because every time people talk about Africa, it's always a famine, everybody's poor. But that don't mean everything is sad. You know, in Mali, you can hear music everywhere. Every morning, people are very happy. So for me, it's a life. I try to explain that in my show. The album is also like that, something very intimate.
It doesn't get much more intimate than a girl's right to grow up with her sex organs intact. In the song Boloko, which Fatou says was her most difficult to write, she asks how women can allow the practice of female genital cutting when so many girls die afterwards or survive mutilated and traumatized.
The refrain, it's Mama Abendimi. That means Mama, ça fait mal.
It hurts.
Mama, it's very heavy.
I salute your courage.
Thank you. But I'm not here to be fighting with people about that. I'm just in my songs, I put different questions I'm asking to ourselves and African generation. If we need this tradition for the future.
Hans Finger, one of Fatou's fans in Cologne, thinks Mali's future looks a little brighter thanks to Sterntaler, a German aid organization that builds schools in central Mali and outside the capital, Bamako. He told me more after Fatou's concert in Cologne.
On one hand, Mali is one of the least developed countries in the world, and on the other hand, it's a country where people are so full of energy, like Fatou today. It's fascinating to me.
Active since 2008, Sterntaler hopes to build a third and possibly fourth school in Mali this year if the political turmoil subsides. With a teacher training program in place, Sterntaler has helped provide education to 100 children who had no access to school before. But as Hans explains, there's more to this aid relationship than altruism.
It's also about communicating, learning about the other culture. Also the other way around, of giving them information about our culture, that they get an impression how things happen here in this country.
And it was this country, Germany, that fired up Momo Sissoko's imagination during his boyhood in Mali.
J'ai aimé en tant que petit la marque made in Germany. Donc j'aimais par exemple la BMW, les Mercedes, les Audi.
Impressed by German cars that held up better than anything else on the rough roads of Bamako, Momo thought whatever country produced them must have a lot of know-how and discipline. That's what he came here to cultivate. Momo is training to become a soccer coach at Cologne's renowned sports university. His dream is to build up a world-class team in Mali. But when he listens to Clandestin, Fatou's lament about the thousands of African migrants who've lost their lives at sea on their way to Europe, he's reminded of someone he played soccer with all through his youth. Mambi, one of Momo's closest friends, was determined to get to Europe any way he could. Ignoring his teammates' warnings not to take the risk, he made his way to Morocco, where he boarded a fishing pirogue bound for Spain.
Une grande pirogue a chaviré, donc en mer, et malheureusement, il était parmi les victimes.
A few months later, Momo received word that Mambi drowned when the boat capsized. He was just 25.
Every day, many young Africans are dying on the sea. Now, it's happening now. So in my songs, I try to say, African politicians, help our generation to stay in Africa, to think about a new Africa, because we need them for the future.
Okay, but someone might say, well, you went, so
yes,
I want to go too.
To them, don't go this way, because we're going to die. Africa needs you. Stay at home. Have some dream, positive dreams for your country.
Fatoumata Jawara singing her dreams for Africa. For DW, this is Alexa Dvorsen.
Malian singer Fatou wrapping up today's edition of World in Progress. For more information on issues around globalization and development, please go to our website at dw.de/globalization. You can also listen to reports or download the show as podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time with a new edition of World in Progress. On behalf of today's studio team here in Bonn, Nigel Tanby and Gerd Georgi, I'm your host Anke Rasper saying thanks for listening and goodbye. Jamambara, tunganta ga majalula. Jamambara.
fila sabana ninduru woro wolon fila shigi konanton olube sankele fila sabana ninduru woro wolon fila shigi konanton